I'll talk to you tonight. Share some reflections. So this past month, I saw a New Yorker cartoon. Let me get myself in. I saw a New Yorker cartoon that resonated. Two people are walking down a city street, and one says to the other, "My desire to be well-informed is currently at odds with my desire to remain sane." I think it's a dilemma for many people these days. And it centers around how are we able to touch the suffering and the problems in the world, the suffering and the problems in our own life, without becoming overwhelmed by them, or just living in this constant state of upset or dukkha, right? And in our sangha, what I had just mentioned, we offer this online check-in service where people sign up for their 20-minute interviews about the practice. And I found that this inner overwhelm is a consistent subject of conversation for those seeking counsel. I hear narratives like, and of course I'm not referring to any one person. I sit regularly, and I thought my practice is going well, and then this happened. Something in political life, something in their personal life, someone said something that really rankled them, an unwanted circumstance occurred, like my heating going out and your air conditioning going out. And the person gets caught, okay? You get caught and you suffer when you get caught. And the meditator may even be clear that the incident or what the other person said or did is not the real source of the problem. And this is two-thirds of the practice, okay, to realize that. But they still can't let go of how they feel, becoming enmeshed in the story or hijacked by the mood or mind state that they're experiencing. So, you know, I'll hear, "I've been meditating all this time and it's so upsetting because I feel angry or depressed or jealous or afraid. My practice really isn't working," right? And maybe that sounds familiar. And it's not just us here embroiled in the dramas of modern life, right? Ajahn Chah, the 20th century master, saw this with monks in his own forest monastery. He told them, "Bhikkhus, here we are, sitting still, we feel at ease, but if someone comes along and insults us, we go running after the mood. We've left our spot. The mind gets deluded by the mood and goes running after it." That's his words. "And when we do this, we become a moody person, a person who thinks they are their moods. You have to understand," he said, "that all your moods and all your feelings are lies." Okay. Really? Okay. "My whole inner life is a lie?" Right. That can sound like such a stretch, but maybe it's not that hard to see if we take a close look at our daily lives. How is your day? Listen to a little piece of a day of mine. "I was upset by an item on the news. I was delighted by the sweet cherries at lunch. I was so bored in that meeting. I laughed at the puppy playing with a cat on Facebook. I was annoyed by a family member's email. And damn, I forgot to buy the milk for my tea when I went to the store. I enjoyed the neighborhood walk with a friend. I worried about a deadline I might not make in time because I hadn't started the project yet. The hot shower felt great. Ouch, a paper cut when I opened the mail. The Diamondbacks won, yay. So, and my heat went out, right? That's the other thing, all right? So how was my day, right? Is it the mood I have right now? Is it the mood that most sticks with me? Is it whether good moods or bad moods predominated today? You can kind of see how silly it is by the questions. And it's true, really, not only for a day, but for a week, a year, a lifetime, really. It's just the inner weather blowing through, right? These moods and mind states are truly like clouds in the sky. They pass through, and they're gone from the horizon. Whatever made me think that that mood, was who I am. Right? And this is exactly what the Buddha tells us directly about mind states. No thought or mood or emotion is you. There is no better means to overcome suffering, he says, than to see this is not myself, this is not mine. So it's kind of a radical idea to people outside meditation that my inner moods and mind states are not me and not mine. And let me put it an even more radical way. I am not responsible for, nor defined by, the mind states that visit my consciousness. And I think, what a friggin' relief, right? These mind states are a product of causes and conditions that I do not control, and my only job is how I relate to those mind states. Absolutely nothing is to be clung to, the Buddha tells us. And when I cling to mind states, that is what solidifies my sense of self, and therefore, as you all know, my suffering, right? And so when I hear the self-criticism or the self-doubt of a meditator struggling with persistent anxiety who tells me, I meditate regularly, but I am troubled that I'm still an anxious person, my response is, no. The difference between an anxious person and one who experiences anxiety is the identification with the feeling, right? You're getting hooked into a me by a temporary feeling. Bring some compassion and equanimity to this. I've got to tell myself that too, right? When the mind is calm or happy, the Buddha tells us, don't be intoxicated by it. When it's distracted, depressed, or anxious, he tells us, don't be intoxicated by it. Deep stillness of mind, the real tranquility that we are seeking, comes not from being preoccupied with none of it, right? In this way, we have the possibility of being free from our mind states, free from our own inner weather. And this idea of weather is one of two similes that's used in classic Buddhist texts to offer practical help in developing and maintaining an appropriate attitude toward feelings. I'll share these similes tonight, and many of them, many here will know them, in the hopes that the images give you a feel, really that's a felt sense, for how to approach feeling in an onward leading way. So I'm going to begin with the simile of the guest house, which I briefly introduced tonight in our meditation, right? Ajahn Chah used this a lot in his teaching to show a way to relate to feelings as a friendly but uninvolved host who can allow their guests, the feelings, to come and go without becoming overly involved in their business. Okay? That's how he wanted you to relate to feelings and mind states. We sit. Here come the visiting mind states, moods, boredom, restlessness, aversion, maybe interest, calm, concentration. Okay? We don't know who shows up. The point isn't to stop the visitors from arriving, but to remain gracious to all and comfortably seated in our living room chair. From that seat of awareness, we can know who's in the house, but we don't follow them with our thinking. We just know who comes in. Ah, that's aversion. Ah, restlessness. Ah, depression. We label and let go. We don't lose our minds, our consciousness, to the visitor. And Ajahn Chah wanted us to experience a crucial insight here in dealing with mood, that the mood, or the visitor, and the mind, by which he means, he meant awareness, are two separate things, okay? The mind, the awareness, and the mood. Normally, he said, if you have, and this is how we mix it up in life, how most people do, if we have a good mood, the mind is good also. We see them as the same thing. If we have a bad mood, the mind goes bad as well, right? No, he says, you're mixing them up. You have to separate them out and see what the mind is like, what the mood is like. And whether we experience mental states which the world knows as good or a bad visitor, he tells us we don't forget ourselves, our consciousness. We stay in the easy chair of awareness. We don't allow the visitor to grab us out of our seat. They don't own the house, right? They will leave too on their own. And we can note when they're gone. And that's an important thing. Oh yes, the restlessness has gone. We begin to see the temporary nature, the fleeting nature of everything, of moods. And once you begin to trust this, who shows up doesn't matter. There they are, you are here, and that's what Ajahn Chah means by they're two separate things. Okay. It doesn't matter what mind states visit you. They will leave eventually. It's a very different way to look at our inner life. And we can do this in life too, not just on the meditation cushion. So I want you to listen. I'm going to read something from the editor of Tricycle. Do you get that magazine? It's a Buddhist magazine. How she talks about how it changed the way she approached how she changed the way she approached her anxiety. Okay? So I'm quoting from her article. She says, about 20 years ago, my therapist quietly said to me, Beth, what's happening is that you're even anxious about the possibility of being anxious. Bingo, I thought. I was living in a constant state of hypervigilance, and when you're skilled at scanning for threats, you become convinced that the worst outcome lurks around every corner. Why wasn't I invited to that meeting? Will my daughter's cough get worse? What if the bank doesn't approve the mortgage? For much of my life, I ruminated on elaborate worst-case scenarios backed up by evidence, she has in quotes, and played out in detail in my mind over and over. I'd perfected the art of thinking, planning, and worrying. Fortunately for me, that very day, my therapist offered to lend me a trio of books by Pema Chodron. They taught me how to stay with the waves of emotion, watching their rise and fall instead of fighting them. And I learned it was okay and safe to hang out in the gap between my arising emotions and future outcomes. It changed my life. And maybe you can hear that even though the writer here isn't using the same language as the guest house that I just did, can you really see it's the same technique? Okay. We just watch the mind states come and go, whether it's anxiety or something else. We watch them rise and fall. And more then, we move to the seat of awareness. And from there, it's possible to see, as Mark Twain said, some of the worst things in my life never happened. All right, the weather simile that I introduced briefly earlier is another approach that may help in dealing with moods and mind states. And I'm betting that everyone in here knows how futile it is to spend your time trying to change the weather. This is true of your inner weather, too. It's just causes and conditions playing out. You can't change your inner weather. And that is something that it's taken me personally years to be able to really get, that I cannot change my inner weather. But you can wear a raincoat. Okay. Your raincoat, your protection from the inner weather, is mindfulness. It doesn't stop the weather, but it stops the weather from getting truly under your skin, from getting us deeply wet, if you want to put it that way. And that's what's traditionally called in the texts, guarding the sense doors. And that's, guarding the sense doors is a very interesting Buddhist concept, and it's often misunderstood to mean that you just don't let experience in, you know? If the news bothered me, turn it off, okay? If I can't deal with that person, I just never have any contact with them, okay? If life is too much, I go live in a cave, right? Or zone out in meditation, so I don't have to experience any weather that disrupts my mind, okay? This is not the instruction. If I simply shut out strong feeling, I end up spiritually bypassing, right? Not dealing with the emotions or the moods or the situations in my life that require attention. But on the other hand, at the other extreme, with unwise attention, when I'm immersed in the dramas of my life, I can also spend my time stuck in these storms and stuck in these dramas. Our road, the Buddhist road, is the middle way. So back to the weather, it's we feel the rain without getting drenched. We use a raincoat. Norman Fisher, the Zen practitioner and writer, describes this middle way in his sitting practice as learning to be, and this is his phrase, to be disturbed without being disturbed. Okay. An interesting turn of phrase. When I sit, he says, I open to the different emotions that visit and let them go. And it helps me to do the same thing when I do it on the cushion during the rest of my day. I want to be disturbed in life. When I read about or I see dismaying things, I want to be dismayed. I want to cry when there's something to cry about. What allows an emotion to take you over, becoming what Buddhists call a klesha, right, or a poison, right, is the clinging to it, right? It's not the emotion. So my practice is to fully experience it and then let it go. To be disturbed, in other words, without being disturbed. That's what he means. That's where I put my effort, is what he tells us. And I find that's an interesting way to put it. And the people I know who have learned how to deal gracefully with emotional storms all do this. I have an amazing Dharma buddy, a very experienced meditator, who just had a surprise diagnosis just this month of kidney cancer. And she had to have her kidney taken out. She described to me how she's dealing with the post-cancer surgery and diagnosis, which includes full radiation, full chemo, having to do everything. Okay? And this is how what she said. I asked her whether I could share it. I just remember that the waves of fear do move through and pass if I don't grab hold of them or fight with them. Okay. Kind of amazing. Right? So there it is again, you know, kind of the same advice. Can you feel without grabbing onto the feeling? So can you tell when you're grabbing onto a feeling? Usually I find with myself there's a story that goes with the feeling that's what makes it sticky. Okay. And then I can notice a cascade of repeating thoughts about what's going to happen in the future or why it happened or shouldn't have happened and what I should do or not do, how it could be different. Okay. There's a whole narrative about it. Is it possible to just feel the energy, the wave of sensation of the feeling, without the entanglement of repetitive thought, without fueling it with the story? Okay. Because without the fuel, the flame of the feeling dies out on its own. And that's what Ajahn Chah meant. The visitor just leaves. Right? The visitor leaves the house. Yungi Mingmor Rinpoche, who again I know many of you will know, who has written some wonderful books like In Love with the World, dealt with some terrible panic attacks as a child. And he writes about first trying to divert his attention from the panic and how this didn't work. right? And then he turns toward it, accepting and investigating mindfully. And this is when he first sees the strands of the panic, is what he calls it. It just the coming together of a certain bodily energy with certain thoughts and images. Really, that's all feeling is. It's a certain bodily energy. I may have certain thoughts. I may have certain images that come with it. And they come together, and boom, it's depression, or it's something. Okay? Seeing them in this way, he said, they became less solid, not him. Just conditions, a sensation, a thought, an image, arising in tandem. And this kind of penetration of his mental weather allowed him to stop living in the storm under the weather, right? So his advice for strong emotions is simply this. Don't try to fight the storms. Try to connect with the sky itself, with awareness, right? And in so doing, things don't cease. They just don't land. You see the difference? The feelings just don't land. And here we come again to what to me is the exact same insight that we've been talking about. To be disturbed without being disturbed. The feelings come, they don't land. The rain is there, the weather, I don't get wet inside. The mindfulness keeps it something else. To feel the rain without being soaked. To know the visitors without being pulled from your seat. They're all, the two similes really end up in the same place. And I think it's significant that the wisdom, you know, ends up pointing to the same thing. The Venerable Anilyo, you know, the master meditator who's translated many, many Buddhist texts into English, writes, this shift in perspective, where one remains aware of feelings without giving in to their affective pull, will lead to a gradual emerging from the tendency to react to feelings and thereby fuel the dependent arising of dukkha. It's a mouthful, but wow, this is the step out of suffering, right? Every time a strong emotion occurs and this shift happens, it can be a workshop for you. Because the practice is really meeting each moment of feeling this way. Not having it in our minds that that's what we do, but meeting each moment that way. And it's only in the very moment of that emotion that the opportunity is there, right? Can we touch it and let it go? In this way, our strong emotions like panic or anger and upset, or persistent anxiety, or cancer diagnosis fear, right? They become the doorway to ending suffering. So, may you know your moods as visitors. May you stay in touch with the sky as the inner weather passes through. Okay. Thank you for your attention tonight. And there's probably some time here if people want to comment or add or
I'm so blown away by your talk. I can't thank you enough. Just before coming on tonight, I was having a conversation with a friend in New York, 3,000 miles away, who I met at Spirit Rock 1,000 years ago, and who is in her early 90s. And we were just having this conversation, not as in depth and not as eloquently and fabulously as you just did, but I remember saying she quoted something from Sylvia Boorstin, which of course my brain in this exact second is not remembering. And I remember saying a quote I heard many, many years ago that was attributed to the Dalai Lama: "If you can do something about it, why worry? If you can't do something about it, why worry?" I wish I could remember the Sylvia quote. And I probably saw you recently at Eric's memorial.
Yes.
Thank you so much for this talk tonight. I will definitely be listening to it again. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Appreciate it. Well, I don't feel that we have to stay till exactly, the time either. If we're complete, we're complete.
Kathy
Sure,
Barbara has a
Vita.
question.
Sure,
Kathy
Vita.
Barbara has a question.
Oh, sure.
Hi. I enjoy this talk immensely. I do a lot of these practices. And but I wanted to ask one question because sometimes I can feel my emotion just tugging me anyway. And it's sort of like, and if you said something that touched me, I thought I'd like to hear a little more about it. Say it's safe to stay in the gap between rising emotions and future outcomes.
Well, that was her. That was a quote from the woman from Tricycle. But notice the strength of the tug. You just said the tug, right? I think that can be helpful to just realize that this is, in a sense, an external force, right? That tug. And just realize that it's trying to pull you under. It's trying to pull you in. And sometimes seeing it in that way is helpful to being the person in the armchair rather than following the visitor everywhere. And I guess we should be muting when we're not on, so that we're not getting the feedback.
Yeah, I find that helpful because the word tug is like a physical force, and yet at the same time, it's very easy to just, it turns into an emotion. And then before I even have a coherent thought or a story about the emotion, there's that physical, ugh, and it's out, it's like an ambience of all these stories and thoughts.
And sometimes I have found it useful to do what Nyingor Rinpoche was talking about, to see the strands. Sometimes when a thing is very strong, to just see that all it is the coming together of this thought with this bodily feeling, with that image in my mind, and that when that happens, all of a sudden it feels like something, but it's not. It's just, a rainbow, right?
Or a shower.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah. I think there was somebody else who was looking to no more Vita.
Rick Powers.
Okay.
Flowers. Sorry.
Okay.
Yes, I thank you very much. It's a wonderful idea that you presented. I can use it a lot, often very a lot, but how can I apply it to the anxiety of the Trump monster in the coming election? It just never seems to go away.
I'll tell you, Rick, I have my own problems with that, too. You know the story, the Buddhist story of kind of not so fast about thinking about good and bad?
No,
where the horse, where there's a man has a son and he teaches him to ride and he rides and he falls off the horse and oh no, you know, it's gone. Oh,
yeah,
but
yeah,
then what happens is, right, you know, then what happens is when they come to recruit people for the war, they can't take that boy because I kind of think of this political cycle in the same, in the same way. If that happens, something else will come from that. Okay? The way it did last time, that in some ways the horrors of the situation produced a different result. You know, it produced something that happened differently. And I think it's the playing out of these things that we're watching. We don't know how this is gonna move in the future. You're thinking of the next month, and the month after that. But you don't know what the long-term effects of this would be. In the same And I think for me, it's useful to think that what will be, if this is where we are as a country, that is what we elected, then there will be some repercussions from that we will live out and then take a next step from there.
Yeah, that's my anxiety entirely. Well, I didn't expect a total solution, but it's good to be reminded of the story.
Yeah.
About there are people said, "Oh, that's terrible," and the guy's teller says, "We'll see."
Right.
And you see the next thing that turned out
right.
for the best.
Right.
Till the next time.
Right. I mean, and the only thing we can do in this is where I come to, it's just a personal belief, in this is uproot greed, hatred, and delusion in ourselves, which makes it easier to help other people do it. And so if we can do that and not hate that other, that is part of what is the uprooting of the things that we think are causing the suffering in the world, right?
Yeah, sometimes I look upon the Trump monster as the anti-Buddha. If you have matter and antimatter, you have Buddha and the anti-Buddha. And he's a lesson. Every day he's a lesson on what not to do. An extreme lesson of the anti-Buddha.
Mm-hmm. But, do you see what your job is in this? It's to not respond in the same way with hatred greed and delusion, you know.
Right. Yeah.
It's to not do that. And then that, you know, that becomes the practice.
And it's challenging,
and I think it will take us beyond where we've been if we can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Well, thank you very much.
It did relieve the anxiety
a bit. And
okay.
Really good story. You told it very well, and
okay.
I really appreciate your lesson tonight and taking part.
Thank you. I really appreciate being with this Sangha, to tell you the truth. You're such experienced meditators, right? And it's lovely to have the references all kind of be something that is known, and it's lovely for me, you know, because I don't get a chance a lot to do talk outside my Sangha, right?
Very nice having you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mary has a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment. And this is, so for me, one of the things that I find that's just so interesting is for my moods and stuff, sometimes where I get caught is when it's good. A lot of times I get caught is when it's good. You know, it's like not anxiety, not anger, not any of that. I was visiting my kiddos, and my other kiddos were here. And when it's really good, and I can just get caught in wanting to grab that and hold that, and like start to move forward when it's not. And it's just so interesting to watch how, like, sit back down and in, be here now, enjoy this. Whatever's happening, my happiness or with the pleasure that I'm having in this moment, and know that like everything else, it changes. And it's just so funny because for me, that is where I can just get really caught. And it's
a great insight. I mean, really, you know, because this is where a lot of people get, because it's easy to see the suffering in the negative stuff, right? But it's hard to see the suffering in attaching to the positive stuff. And so that's, you know, that's a great insight, that it has a thorn in it. You know, if you grab onto it, it'll bite you, you know, it'll get you, right? And you'll suffer from the thing that you loved, right? That's a great insight.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
About the thorn?
Yeah, I didn't quite understand. Well,
anything that you grab onto, you know, that you cling to, eventually results in suffering. And if you cling, I mean, let me take the easiest example that's... you know, of a sunset, right? If that is, oh my God, that sunset is so gorgeous, and you're watching it, and then it, you know, it fades. And if you're holding on to it, there's a little suffering in it, right? There's a little suffering in letting it go.
Mm-hmm.
But you can think of this in really distinct ways with a person.
Mm.
You know, with a relationship, with, you know, and I've seen people who, you know, if the clinging is too much, which might be take the form of jealousy, let's say, in a relationship, that can actually cause the suffering in the relationship that breaks it up. Right? There's so many things that if you hold on to it, you can notice in subtle ways. When I have, you know, once a month I get a massage, right? Mm-hmm. And I can notice sometimes at the end of the massage, when I know there's just like a minute left, that there's a little suffering in it, you know, because I don't want it to stop, right? And I notice that, oh, isn't that amazing? You know, just that little grabbing. And so I get to have a little suffering in my massage. Well, you get to have a lot of suffering, you know, depending on how much you cling to anything.
Okay. Like a good meal or something. Or I'm trying to...
Well, if it's a restaurant, let's take the good meal example. So I had this great meal. I mean, it was so amazing, right? But next time I go to the restaurant, I'm going to order the same thing, right? Okay. Was it as good? It better be as good. Otherwise, I'm going to suffer a little. Do you see? If I cling to it. If I cling to it, I will, you know, I will end up suffering in that way.
Well, clinging to people, you mentioned. I can see that one. I mean, I've had that happen. But,
okay. Well, it's really true. I mean, in some ways you have to investigate for yourself. But the holding on to anything, I'm in a situation now, you know, I've lived in my home for 35 years, okay? And I love Flagstaff and I love my home. And I'm at the point where my spouse is having trouble at this altitude and we have to consider moving, okay? So to the extent that I hold on to my home and my love of my home and my love of my neighborhood and my love of that, to the extent I do that, this will be suffering for me. Can you see that, Annie?
Yeah, I can. What's okay. coming up for me is that I seem to feel a lot of shame in the asking questions here. But that's a whole other topic maybe. But I don't know why. But I mean, I just feel like a dummy but or something like that. Not really a dummy. But anyway, never mind about that.
don't worry about the questions. You know, people have different come to meditation groups in, from all different places and with all different years of experience and everything. And the questions you're asking are very valid.
Okay. Well, I sat with the Sangha in, when it was in person for about 7 years. Mm-hmm. And I do a half hour quiet time every morning for my 12-step group. But however, my quiet time has been very noisy lately, I will say. I don't know if people... I know people know what I mean here. Just many thoughts, and I can quiet down maybe for 2 minutes, but do you have any comment on that? And then I'll retire my questions.
Yes, I think you should not fight the thoughts that are coming. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's the fighting of the thoughts, and it's the fact that I'm not this good meditator because I've been doing this for 7 years and I have all these thoughts. Okay? That's the thing that's getting you. That's the thing that's pulling you under.
Yeah, I notice if I just say thank you for the ideas, you know, from what source I feel, Mother Earth, the Great Spirit, then it kind of, you know, that works for me. A little bit. I don't know. But it's just thank you for ideas that I'm having that are good ideas. And I'm glad they're coming to me in my quiet time meditation.
I don't even think it's necessary in your quiet time to follow the ideas or look at the ideas. Just know that ideas are happening, right? Ideas are happening. And look to the place that knows that the ideas are happening.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay.